I'm going to get started now, and then other people can drift in if they like. I have on the screen here the Sunday Week in Review section and the story that I gave you the link for if you wanted to read it. We'll be talking about that in a few minutes. I wanted to start, though, by reading, when I got here as the journalist in residence at KITP, I was reminded of a novel that I'd read years ago. I wonder if any of you know it, Galatea 2.2 by Thomas Powers, Richard Powers. If you know Richard Powers' novels, he writes these novels that have a lot of science in them. One of them is called The Goldbug Variations, and it plays on this idea of the Goldberg variations in mathematics, and it's set in a genetics lab that's trying to crack the final secret of life through the genetic code. And they're not really science fiction. They're considered literature and not part of that genre, but I'm not sure exactly what the difference is. I don't know. And I think it's whether they get full page reviews in the New York Times Book Review or if they get stuck in the science. Yeah, but you know, it sounds sounds fairly arbitrary. But he's a good writer too. This book, Galatea 2.2, starts out with somebody who's been named humanist at residence. Humanist in residence is something called the Center for the Study for Advanced Sciences. And it's sort of oddly like what I'm doing here and oddly like KITP, and yet in some ways completely divergent. So it's like a different minima, I guess, in the landscape of these things. It's kind of a fun, and this guy is actually a novelist who's coming to do that, unlike me, who writes nonfiction. And the Institute of Advanced Sciences is at his alma mater, which he just refers to throughout the book as U. He says, beginning somewhere in chapter one, "My official title was visitor. Unofficially, I was the token humanist. My third novel earned me the post. The book was a long, vicarious recreation of the scientific career I never had. The center saw me as a liaison with the outside community. It had resources to spare, the office cost them little, and I was good PR. And who knew a professional eavesdropper with a track record might find no end of things to write about in an operation of this size? The university put me up in a house. I bought a secondhand bike, perfect for the stretch from my house to the center. The complex had sprung up since my last visit. A block-long building in a town the size of you, his university town, cannot help but make a statement. The center's architecture laid irony upon irony. It was a postmodern rehash of Flemish Renaissance. The center had been built by an ancient donor couple, two people archaic enough to get through life still married to each other. They reached the end of that shared existence with nothing better to do with the odd 50 million than to advance science. The university got a warrant of offices, computer facilities, conference areas, wet and dry labs, and an auditorium and cafeteria, all under that jumble of Flemish gables. The small city housed several hundred scientists from assorted disciplines. Thankless PhD candidates did the bulk of the experimental drudge work, supervised to various degrees by senior researchers from all over the world. Work at the center divided into areas so esoteric I could not tell their stature from their names. Half the fields were hyphenated. Creative play spilled over borders, cross-pollinating like hybrid corn and heat. Talk in its public spaces sounded like a UN picnic, excited, wild, and mutually unintelligible. I loved how you could never be sure what a person did, even after they explained it to you. Most attention converged on complex systems." And here it begins to sound a lot more like the Santa Fe Institute back in my hometown, and sometimes it sounds a little more like the Salk down in La Jolla. All of the vertex of several interesting rays, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, visualization and signal processing, neurochemistry, sat the culminating prize of consciousness's long adventure, an owner's manual for the brain. With its countless discrete and massively parallel subsystems, the center seemed to me like a block-wide analog of that neuronal mass it investigated. The building teemed with job descriptions, theorists, experimentalists, technicians, magicians. Someone who had a probe attached to every conceivable flicker. One wing swarmed with scientists who proclaimed their transcendence over engineering. Another housed engineers who didn't even acknowledge the distinction. But one floor banished bread like mold in a nearby quarter. The center was big, so big I lost my office twice in the first month, the way you lose a rental in an airport parking lot. Sheer size was the center's chief virtue. Even the embarrassment of talking to the same colleague twice faded in a place so huge. In such an expanse, I hoped one year would be too brief for me to be of any but passing interest to anyone. The job was perfect. I worked alone, all night. For part of the shift, I had nothing to do but read. I read Rabelais, Balzac, Freud, Henry Adams, Max Planck. I read at random, obeying only the forgotten principles of pleasure. So that in a slightly skewed alternate universe is sort of how I felt at least my first few days here.
Did the novel have a happy ending?
No. It's the conceit of the novel is that the humanist in residence gets hooked up with an AI guy who's trying to recreate, of course, an artificial conscious being and doing it with neural networks. And the author or the protagonist is hired to read novels and books to the computer, and it slowly develops a sense of where it is. There's actually a very poignant passage toward the end where the computer, whose name is Helen, of course, asks, they're talking about books, and she asks, the artificial intelligence, how many books are there? She sounded suspicious, fatigued. A lot, I broke it to her. I had numbered every hair on her head, but in those counting systems, that jumps from three to many. Tell me, I told her that the Library of Congress contained 20 million volumes. I told her the number of new books published increased each year and would soon reach a million worldwide. That a person through industry, leisure, and longevity might manage to read in one life half as many books as are published in one day. Helen thought, they never go away, books? That's what print means. The archive is permanent. Reading population gets bigger? And Helen asked. No, it's not as rapidly as the backlist. People die. Helen knew about death. It was epidemic in literature. Do people get any longer, year in and year out? Oh, is the lifespan increasing? Only on average and very slowly, much less than we pretend. So she did the rate equations and two unknowns. Two more days, the less likely that any book will be read. Oh no, the more days, the less likely any book will be read. That's true. Or that you have read the same things as anyone you talk to. And there are more days every day. Will anything change? Not that I can think of. Always more books, each one read less, she thought. The world will fill with unread print, unless print dies. Well, we're kind of working on that, I guess. Cheery thought for a writer. You know, he's still a print guy. I thought, you know, some of you I know and I've interviewed for stories I've done for the Times. Sometimes these are news stories for the Tuesday Science section. Increasingly, I'm doing more essays either for Science Times or for the Sunday Week in Review, where I worked as an editor for about 8 years, mostly because I'm finishing up a book now. But, you know, you kind of go through byline withdrawal, so occasionally you do these things. The reason this is the third most blogged, or no, most emailed, this probably has nothing to do with the quality, but because of other reasons that we'll find here, of people who are emailing it around, not for entirely salutarious reasons. We'll skip this ad. But I thought it'd be fun just to give you a background of how these things happen, you know, how it is that this story appeared in the Times, and just show you a little of the process, some of the nuts and bolts. You know, like they say, you know, like making salami, you should never see the process. But these things can start in one of two ways. Either an editor will ask you to do something or you propose it to the editor. In this case, I was here kind of feeling at loose ends, and I thought, well, if I'm the science writer in residence, it'd be good to try to write something, you know, and you know, then I can, you know, seem like I'm working in my office. And so I sent this to Henry Fountain, who's the guy at the Sunday Week in Review, who usually edits the science program stories. And I also sent it to Katie Roberts, who's an old friend, who's the editor-in-chief of the Week in Review. And, you know, just, the Nobel Prize had come out, and I was paying no attention to the news that day, and then I heard Sean had mentioned it in his talk last week at the at the physics building, and I thought, oh, yeah, I should go back and look at that. And then I realized it was Smoot's work with the Kobe result, and I remember his line that got a lot of criticism and a lot of publicity and a really good book deal for him and my friend Key Davidson about the seeing the face of God and the ripples of the cosmic background radiation. So at this point, you know, I don't really know what I'm going to write. I'm just suggesting that there's probably an angle here, so that, you know, of course we have our story in the paper about this, about the Nobel Prize itself and what they did. So I'm kind of looking for some oblique angle. And, you know, they basically said, okay, you know, that's great. We'd love to have it. And I just gathered together the email in one queue here to make this a little easier. And just a lot of back and forth. And you know, this mostly consists of when can we have it? We've really got to see something. So this was on a Wednesday. And by Thursday, you need to at least have, you know, a pretty good summary of what you're going to do, because you have to give it to the art director to start, you know, getting someone to do a cartoon or to find some photographs to use and to start designing the page. So the second day, so I, you know, by the time they said they wanted it, it was kind of halfway through Wednesday. So I went back to my apartment and worked on it that evening, and then got up the next morning and came in here and worked on it. And by probably about late Thursday, I had a draft that I sent to Henry. So, you know, about 24 hours later, you know, of course I slept in between. This must be it. Let's see what it looks like. It's probably pretty rough. I didn't have as many of the iterations of this as I sometimes have when I do these things. And awfully slow. Great software. It's way better than Word. I guess this was pretty. What are they doing? Yeah. Oh, it's opening every. Let's see.
All of
them. Hope there's nothing embarrassing. Wow. Yeah. No, just all the passwords to my bank account. Nothing important. Okay. This is actually. Yeah, this is more complete than I was hoping to have something a little rougher. But, you know, this is basically what I had about a day later. And, you know, you've already read the stories, so I won't look at it too closely. There's one line, this in the first draft, that will be interest to Dr. Kirshner, I think, here, who figures into our story later, where it says, if only it had been that simple, 6 years after Kobe, another Berkeley scientist, so we referred to a Berkeley scientist, so I had this nice transition, so another Berkeley scientist, Saul Perlmutter, found the early burst of expansion never ended. Once again, the universe is still in overdrive, etc., etc. Now, later I thought about that, and I remembered there was indeed another team, and I changed the sentence to hedge that a bit, but not entirely successfully in everyone's view. I see by opening it not in Word, I'm getting the edit. I'm not getting the edit trace. But so usually I write these in this program and then pull them into Word, because that does have good edit trace stuff. So this kind of went on. It gets different toward the end, because, you know, I'd worked much more on the beginning, and then. So it's kind of similar. I had a completely different ending here, which was based on a conversation I had with the scientist here out in the patio, and I didn't really like it. Mostly, I mean, it's really hard knowing how to end these things sometimes. You don't want them to just stop, and it's not like the old newspaper wire service stories where you write them in what they call the inverted pyramid, where you have the important information here and a little less important here, and it kind of narrows down. And they do that so they can literally chop it from the bottom and put it in the page. And fortunately, they don't do that in the Week in Review, so you try to converge towards some kind of nice ending that seems like, you know, seems like an ending. It doesn't just, you know, just stop. So I didn't like this, but I figured it worked for a while.
Would you like us to interrupt the way we do our colleagues, or would you like to say your piece?
It won't be much longer, and then why don't we talk? Yeah. Is that okay?
Great.
Okay. So, anyway, this was an early draft as of Thursday night, and then Henry read it, and he got back to me with an email with, you know, first it was mostly stuff that he completely didn't understand. And Henry's a really, really smart man, and, you know, has worked for Science Times before he was at the Week in Review as an editor. But there was stuff that he found completely opaque. And the biggest pressure that we're under when we write these things is from editors saying, look, you know, remember, you're not writing these for your scientist friends and for the people you interviewed. You're writing these for the general public. And these are people who are interested in science, and they find it fascinating what scientists do. They don't have a lot of background. They don't tend to remember a whole lot from one story to the next. So you really have to bring it down to a more accessible level. And it's still a pretty high level New York Times readers. It's not as if I were doing this for my first newspaper where I worked, the Albuquerque Journal. But, you know, still, that's the main pressure you're getting at this point. So I talked to Henry on the phone, and he told me the parts that he thought were completely incomprehensible. And then I did another version, and I'll just show you one more draft, and then and get on to the controversy, which is the fun part. So this would have been the this must have been the final version now that Henry sent back to me that was edited. And you want to revert to the save? No. Let's see. But it wasn't 14 years ago. That was one thing I realized when I was fact-checking that I caught. And this is just, you know, little editing, and mostly it's just word editing. And then Henry still thought the piece around here was incomprehensible, so I sent him a sub-paragraph that he put in, which is what that is. I mean, the editors don't write much into your stories, at least they don't with me. They're mainly trying to make sure they're clear. So this is, you know, some of Henry's editing, and mostly really, really good. Usually everything that they do tends to improve the piece. I mean, sometimes it's just, you know, you'll get something back from an editor you've never worked with, who's never worked with you, and it's, you know, just kind of a shock, and then you have to complain. But this went very, very smoothly. So anyway, we ended up doing another. This is now probably Friday morning. We probably did two or three more drafts back and forth. The Week in Review closes Friday at about midnight. So, and then Henry and I are going back and forth. And then after Henry, it goes to two more editors. And of course, they have questions and things they think are totally incomprehensible. So you get it back and have to do more editing. So now, like, 2.5 days later, Friday night, I'm at home, probably about 9, 10 o'clock, finishing this up finally and getting my final playback of how it's going to appear in the newspaper. And the last thing I do before I do this is I take the piece, I print it out, I start with the first sentence, and I go through with a yellow highlighter, and I read that sentence, remember where I got every bit of information. If I'm slightly unsure, I go back and check it. I go through the whole thing neurotically, compulsively like this, and usually like at 11 o'clock I'll be sending Henry a few final little fixes, and then I'll be calling him to make sure he gets them. So then you go to bed, and while you're sleeping they print 2 million copies of these things. Spread them all over the world, and then for anyone who missed that, they put it on the World Wide Web so everyone can read it. And you get up the next morning, open up your computer, and see, of course, all the people praising you for the fine story that you've written. Would that it were the case. So, but for the first few days, I didn't hear anything. I got a really nice email from a physicist, and even one I didn't know at Caltech, saying that he, you know, just really liked the piece for all the reasons that I also liked it, and that was nice. And then a few days later, got a letter from, I mean, an email from Dennis, who's, you know, my colleague, who most of you probably know, says, FYI, I got the same message from Adam Reese, the member of the other team that discovered dark energy. And this is an email from Bennett, not Bob Bennett,
Chuck
Bennett. Just describing that, you know, I'd mentioned Perlmutter, of course, and not the Schmidt team. And then I'm kind of kicking myself and thinking, well, you know, I knew there was another team, and I showed you that I had, I thought I had fudged it enough, and so this involves an email going back and forth with Chuck Bennett, and I basically said, look, you know, in an ideal world, I definitely would have remembered and I would have named the other team, but in an essay like this, I'm trying to compress in one paragraph, I have 900 words to do the whole thing, trying to compress this whole history, and when I was writing it, it was, you know, right or wrong, the one name that came to my mind was Saul Perlmutter. I put that in, I checked, made sure his spelling was correct. I went back and looked at his bio in various places and saw that, you know, got the dates right and that it was indeed him. And, you know, my own failing, I'd forgotten, I knew there was another team, but I'd forgotten the details, even though I had lunch with Bob Kirshner just a few months ago in Santa Fe, and we were talking about his book about this. So, you know, it was embarrassing, and what I told Chuck Bennett was what I really should have done is not named anyone in this particular piece. It's not a news story, it's an essay, and I'm trying to evoke some ideas for a general reader. They don't really care about the names, and probably shouldn't have used a name at all, but I felt that by qualifying it and saying almost no one had expected dark energy, but then, you know, until another Berkeley scientist. So, to me, that was kind of a gray area. But anyway, you know, I was thinking about it and then woke up. Yeah, and went through this. You know, I mean, first, you know, friendly email from Bob, you know, greeting me as the science writer in residence, and then sending me a really nice column he wrote on the in the AAAS newsletter about my most recent book, Miss Leavitt's Stars, about the Cepheid variables and measuring the universe, and you know, and then Bob picked up my story and read it, and I think. Blood pressure, you said, right? Yeah, you know, kind of went through the roof, and see that. And then we engaged in a conversation back and forth by email. And again, I was trying to say, well, look, you know, I realize that sentence was imprecise, but I think it wasn't strictly wrong the way I wrote it. And again, I mean, I pleaded in a piece like this. You know, there's just so many things you can get wrong, and of course, you know, what seemed to me a minor point did not seem that way to Dr. Kirshner. So, anyway.
So when you get 2 points on your license for untruths and only 1 point for half-truths?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, something like that. So, it was imprecise and incomplete. So, I mean, maybe you've written something that had a mistake in it. I don't know.
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so. So anyway, I went to bed about 10:30 thinking, well, you know, no problems here. Everything's fine in the universe. And actually, it was in the morning when I got up, and all of these started at 10:24 p.m., which is way past my bedtime, and continued into the morning. And then I opened up my email, and I got all these emails, you know, and I'm reading them in this progression of going from very friendly to outraged. And yeah, I hope this isn't embarrassing. I mean, the reason I'm doing this...
Not to me.
No, I mean, Bob chose to make our personal correspondence public, so I figured it was okay. Anyway, it finally ended with this email. Dead horse beating. That was not, it was his subject line, not mine. And a letter that he was submitting to the editor of the New York Times, which I, you know, agreed was a really great idea, and I contacted the editors to make sure they knew about it and would take it in. It was a very nice, you know, nicely put, and I really appreciated the praise in the first paragraph and a way to set the, you know, record straight in case who gets the Nobel Prize is really hinging on who read my one particular story on page C3 that day of the Times, but you know, it's perfectly right to do this letter. But then I got on my bicycle and drove to work, you know, and I felt that, you know, we'd reached kind of a friendly. You know, I rode my bicycle to work, clicked onto the computer, and find that there's another letter that's being sent to the public editor, and this is the Times ombudsman. And this one, you know, I thought was not very, you know, disregard of truth, and, you know, and basically attaching all of our correspondence on the bottom. So, you know, I mean, that's fine. I mean, we interview people all the time, you know, and then use this information. Anyway, I haven't heard back from the public editor. But meanwhile, I talked to Katie Roberts, and we decided, well, she can't guarantee that Bob's letter is going to run or not. That's outside of her bailiwick. So the result is that we will run a correction on Sunday. Let's see if I can find the correction. Well, anyway, just it doesn't do much good. It'll appear on the second page of the paper in a box, and it will say that the story in the New York Times incompletely described, and then they will mention the Schmidt team, and then we'll hope we don't hear from individual members on the team saying we should remember all their names too. But no, I mean, the reason and Bob and I maintain a very friendly relationship, I hope, after this, but
when you get a sense
of what it's like, and you write these stories and you have two people reading over your shoulder, over your left shoulder is this huge horde of people who need to have the simplest things explained, and these editors who represent them and who think you're being hopefully obscure and writing for the insiders, and then you have the scientists over your other shoulder who are reading and going through every little sentence. Millions of these people, or at least thousands all over the world, looking for errors. So it's very stressful, and just wanted to give you a sense of how that worked. And yeah, and the result is we'll run a correction because we, you know, that's the policy to do that. And then you move on. You know, you write about something else. So that's my inside view at the Solani stuffing or cutting of making a news story for the New York Times. It's probably similar elsewhere, except there's probably fewer editors involved and they're less likely to make corrections. And just open it up now to your comments and questions.
I was going to ask about something you said before you got into the interesting controversial stuff.
Oh, the science. Yeah, right.
Now, you made a distinction between news stories, reporting news stories, and an essay like this one.
Oh, huh.
And I'm curious to know how what you're trying to accomplish in an essay like this differs from what you're trying to accomplish in a news story.
Yeah, well, with a news story, you're reporting the event that these two scientists got the Nobel nomination and will be going to Stockholm, and the story will give some context to say what it was about, and the story that was in Science Times was it's fairly short. You know, sometimes they do bigger ones, and it's, I'm not sure why this one was shorter than others, but mostly I wanted to put it into a larger context and write what we sometimes call a think piece and just kind of use it to, you know, it's really a form of intellectual entertainment. You know, people like to read about science and they like to see ideas connected to bigger ideas and something that, and plus it's something where you can have fun with the writing. I mean, I do this because I like to write and I do it because I really, really love science. And it's just a chance to do that. Also, the Week in Review section is something, the genesis of it is it was originally for reprising the news of the week, and it's kind of changed over the years, so it's more of finding people to get an oblique take over something, off of something that happened in the news that week, and kind of use it again as a think piece to maybe create a bigger context and to connect some ideas.
It's a form of entertainment,
yeah.
A chance to do some writing.
Intellectual entertainment. Yeah, you do less reporting, although in some of them you end up end up doing a fair amount, but it's less likely that you'll do formal interviews. On this story, I sat down with three of the scientists I know here at KITP, and we just kind of talked, and they kind of helped me. You know, I mean, not that this was anyone's take but my own, but just kind of helped me shape my ideas and, think about what was important. But quite different from the Science Times news story, which we can talk about. Eva?
To what extent do you send your pieces to scientists
I mean, we're not allowed to do that at the Times. And the reason is they applied the same rules to the science coverage as they would to political coverage, or obviously you wouldn't do that. And I know some of my colleagues have done this. it's honored in the breach by some people. What I do to get around it when I'm doing like one of the big super string stories I did a few years ago, like a Science Times cover piece, since I can't send the story to any of the people I'm interviewing or really anyone in the field, since it's small world, I'll just send questions back and forth. And I found a few people like Steve Giddings here, who I find, and Joe Lickens, another one, that are really good at explaining things at a level that I can understand it, and are very tolerant of getting like 20 or 30 emails over an 8-hour period helping me to clarify things. And I'm not running the actual text by them, but I'm asking them very detailed questions. So it makes it much harder. You end up going through your story, and sometimes I basically just make a copy and then I turn it into 7 paraphrase type questions, since it's not the actual text. And I hear about some of my colleagues and say, oh, we just send them to the scientists. And I think, well, that would be easy, but I can, the idea is the tradition in journalism that you don't surrender editorial control. And even if you have a agreement with someone that, well, you can advise me, but I'm not required to change anything, of course it's a thin line. And, yeah. Someone else? I thought I saw a hand.
Oh, you had a title for this talk, like the word problem. This kind of came up after.
It does on Friday. You get this email from Deborah Storm. You need a title. But what I meant by the word problem, and that came from a conversation. I don't know if Jim remembers it, but you were in Santa Fe. And I was writing an earlier book called Fire in the Mind, and the subtitle of which is Science, Faith, and the Search for Order. There's a chapter that mentions decoherence, and I was trying to write something. I talked to some people, like Wojtek Zurek up in Los Alamos is someone I knew pretty well back then, and we went back and forth, and then I arranged to interview Jim about this. And in this case, with my books, I don't have to follow the same rules, so I will often give passages of my books to people to read to help me get the stuff right. And I think I'd given Jim something to read, and we were talking, and as I recall the conversation, we came to a point where I was asking him about, how I would describe something to do with decoherence, in a clear way for a general reader. And I think Jim said, here's where we come up against the word problem. And we talked a little bit about the word problem and the fact that, in the end, the tools we have to use as writers are the tools of rhetoric and not the tools of mathematics. There's no way you can put a single equation except E equals MC squared in a story in the New York Times. And you can't do much more than that in a science book published by a trade publisher for a general audience. So it's just this idea. So often, you'll especially something in string theory, you're looking for the right metaphor to describe it, which I find the string theorists are doing themselves to describe it to themselves, and you get to the point where you're just, and this is where, going back and forth with Steve, who often suggests good metaphors or tells me if mine are are too far off or not, and you go back and forth, and then eventually it's just like interpretations of quantum mechanics. There's quantum mechanics, which is quantum mechanics, and there's different interpretations and trying to put it into words, and no one is happy with one, it's happy with the other necessarily, and so it is with, say, describing something in super string theory. So a lot of times you write a story like this and you'll get an email from someone who says, oh, you know, you just got this completely wrong. And then you go back and forth with them a little and you realize that, you know, you talk to another scientist and he says, no, that's how I think about it. And you get into the fact that you're using this imprecise human language involving these clumsy things called words to describe something mathematically precise. So it's, you know, it's kind of stuck in the middle. And again, you know, with the two different groups, the specialist and the generalist, reading over your shoulders.
How did you end up a science writer with the Times? Did you always want to be a science writer, or just as a journalist in
the Times? I was going to be a scientist at first, and you know, I was kind of the typical little boy scientist with my Geniac computer kit, and you know, I liked to take apart old radios and guitar amplifiers and things. And I really thought I wanted to be a physicist at some point, and I remember I was going to the University of New Mexico and I took the first, it was kind of an advanced entry level class taught by a gentleman named Victor Regener. And, you know, which I realized later was a pretty big deal to take physics from Victor Regener. But, and I really liked the general ideas, you know, the big ideas. At that time I was reading a lot of Isaac Asimov and other science writers and reading all the, even George Gamow and, and I just really enjoyed reading these, you know, the men who made quantum theory and all these books. I really liked the history and the ideas. And then I got to the first class, you know, where we're starting, you know, back with, you know, Newtonian mechanics. And that was interesting, but I didn't have a lot of patience for doing the problems at the end of the chapter, you know, where you're, let's say, you know, there's a three-story building, each story is 12 feet high, there's a dog in the third story window, you see the ball comes down, it comes back later, you know, 3.6 seconds, you know, and then how old is the dog? So I would sit in this pizza restaurant with my friend taking the class and we'd do these problems, and I finally realized that I really like writing about this stuff, but I didn't, I think I probably had the aptitude to do it or the desire to do it, but I continued to read popular science, and then I just kind of, even though I took a lot of science classes, I drifted more into writing for the school paper and getting into newspapers, and eventually, actually not even eventually, after a few years, I found myself just naturally, you know, covering the science beat for a paper in Minneapolis, and on from there.
We're living at a time when there are fewer and fewer science writers, and often a reporter who's not immersed in science the way you've been is assigned stories of tremendous complexity without the stable of references that you have to check even. Is there any hope on the horizon for getting some consistency in people reporting science, or are you just an anomaly?
No, I mean, you know, what you say is true. There's, you know, many sections, you know, newspapers that had sections devoted to science have either eliminated them, or they think science is medical news, you know, about, you know, health and even exercise, and or semiconductor technology. You know, they'll have the personal computer column and something about, you know, blood pressure. And, I don't know. I mean, and at the same time, there's clearly an audience for these things. You know, semi-popular books come out and they sell pretty well. You can make a living writing those books. So, I don't know. There's just really the sense, I don't quite understand it. I think under, you know, catering to the lowest common denominator, underestimating the intelligence of your public, and also the idea of talking down to your reader instead of, you know, getting them, you know, trying to maybe bring them up a level by, you know, with the writing or explaining something. It's kind of the sense that it's not what people want. The Times is I think a good exception to that. The science staff there is larger than ever. It's, you know, they've recently expanded it. And even though a lot of people tell me they pick up the section and it looks like it's dominated with health news, but I think if you did a comparison with the paper 10 years ago or whenever, you'd find that it was about the same balance. They used to have a science section and a health section, and then they put them together down into one section that really is twice as big, twice as much space. So they call it the news poll, the part of the newspaper that has actual material in it as opposed to the advertisements.
Concerning this point, one of your predecessors explained the evolution of the Scientific American from boring but very authoritative articles written by scientists mm-hmm. to more articles written
yeah.
snappier prose
right.
By journalists,
oh, no.
resulting from the fact that more and more people in business appreciated the importance of technology and science and were interested in reading about it. Lots of popular books like Bob's over here, you know, sell enormous numbers of copies, so people are interested in it. So what's the difference between the newspapers,
yeah.
right, where it's decaying, mm-hmm. and these other sources where it seems to be expanding?
Yeah, I don't know, but it's true that it's changed its nature quite a bit, and not only just is it more journalism now rather than having, you know, an article by Albert Einstein, there's an article in Scientific American once, but also a lot more, you know, they do a lot more business kind of tech kind of writing too, but there still is, you know, still is the science. I mean, maybe there were just too many publications and there, you know, there isn't anything like that. There's survival of the fittest and they're winnowing down. But, you know, there was some time in the early 80s when there were like five, you know, three or four, you know, monthly to weekly science magazines of general interest. But
I guess my question is, if people are interested in reading it there, why aren't they interested
yeah,
in
the newspaper? I don't know. I haven't thought about that.
Pardon?
Do they read the newspaper online?
Buy magazines too. No, it's that nobody buys advertising in the science section.
Yeah.
That is the answer, isn't it?
Possibly. I mean, that's one thing that Corey Dean, who until recently was the Science Times editor, used to say when she talked about the Times, and Science Times in particular, was that they lucked out at the beginning because they got the computer ads, and this is what kept the section alive, but that's not really true anymore since they have this thing called the circuit section. So, yeah, I think it's probably a lot of it's advertisement driven, because if you do a health section, you know, you can get the drug ads. And the Times is, since it's not a publicly, it's not a completely a publicly owned corporation, there's like the voting stock is only held by the family that owns it. And they've so far basically decided that they're happy to take a much less of a profit margin than the standard in the industry. As a result, they're willing to put more money into the editorial side of the product on the theory that quality sells. And, you know, there's always the fear that, you know, some members of the family might, you know, not feel that way in the future, or a new generation. And there's all, you know, there is a class of non-voting stock that is held on Wall Street.
That happened to the St. Louis Post. That happened to the St. Louis Post.
Did it?
Well,
yeah. Yeah, I guess it did. I mean, there's not many of the old family-owned newspapers that are taken over by these chains. And, you know, the first thing that happens is they want to see how they can save money. And unfortunately, you know, the science section's often the first to go. They'll say, well, you know, we'll still have science, but we'll just put it in with the regular news section, and, you know, slippery slope.
But is it something to be concerned about? I mean, people aren't reading papers
yeah.
the way they used to.
Well, yeah, I mean,
information
yeah.
online.
Yeah.
And so forth. So, is it something to worry about? Is the decline of science writing greater than the decline of newspapers?
Yeah, probably not. But, well, yeah, I think it's a little faster than the decline of newspapers. But of course, you know, the thought is that newspapers are moving onto the web.
The papers that are read are the local papers.
Yeah.
About neighborhood news.
Right.
That's what people read the papers for. They don't read
yeah.
national.
Well, plus you get the Times, the Washington Post, and, you know, almost anything national you can get online now. So if it's just a matter of it moving into the electronic domain, which is what everybody hopes, that would be great. But I think you still need someone to filter all this incredible amount of information that is out there. Maybe it'll all be blogs someday.
Yeah, the question is, a lot of the reporting of science reporters, or quote-unquote science reporters, is sociology of scientists. And so the question I have is, how do you deal with, say, controversial statements in science? I mean, to give you one edge to start off with is, you know, there's this whole big deal about cold fusion. Mm. And a lot of scientists say it's just impossible, and a lot of people say maybe it's possible. It's built up in the media, and that is a controversial thing, and there's a question of maybe there's some authority that you can go to say, well, maybe it is impossible to have this cold fusion.
Yeah.
Then there's the other end of this spectrum where you really do have controversies going on in science, among scientists, and I mean, one thing may be just string theory and landscape idea. So how do you deal as a journalist with these controversies? Do you write about them in your articles?
Yeah, if it's a genuine controversy, like with the landscape, I'm sure there's been a number of articles in the Times where, probably by Dennis Overby, where he just was really, you report on the debate because, you know, you as a journalist have, you know, really no way to know which side to come down on, or you'll do that sometimes in one story or in the course of your reporting over maybe a year. You know, you might have a profile of Lenny Susskind, and you know, you'll read it and really say, oh yeah, the landscape, you know, I see why people believe that. But then you might, you know, a few weeks later have an interview with David Gross and, you know, get the other view. So, you know, sometimes I think if, when you see a story that seems unbalanced, you might think that, you know, there'll very likely be a corrective later on, and that sometimes we look at it as the balance existing in the, you know, the run of the coverage over a certain period of time.
Amanda. I don't read newspaper anymore, just a month and a
month. You read them online? You read them online?
I'm stingy, I read them online.
Well, yeah, that's still a newspaper. Yeah.
I don't like paying for diesel and
yeah, yeah.
Trees and those sorts of
things. But if they're online, it's still a newspaper.
But my question was, with this move to the internet and the media are facing and the explosion of the amount of so-called information out there on the internet, how do you think in the future we should see the role of an expert? I mean, mm. It seems that with blogging and many other phenomena that are mushrooming, that there is a lot more circle information out there, but it seems like the signal to noise is certainly decreasing.
Yeah.
So, but what is the role of the expert in this explosion of I can be a journalist too?
Well, filtering the signal from the noise, I think.
Right, and how does that occur? How should that occur?
Yeah,
and
well, that's really, that's kind of up in the air right
expert
now.
Expert scientists and expert journalists, how can that connection be used?
No, it's really,
how do you envision that?
The whole thing kind of seems up for grabs now, which is, if you've looked at the stock prices in newspapers, it's part of the reflection, but just how successfully they can get to the web and keep their position as sort of being the filters of trying to decide what, you know, what's important for you, the general reader, to read. You know, one of the things about the New York Times, when I first got there and was doing my orientation, I was invited to sit in on the meeting they have every day where they decide what's going to go on to page one. And you have an editor from every desk, science desk, foreign news, Metro News, they all get together in this big room with the top editors, you know, then it was Abe Rosenthal and later Joe Lelyveld, and they hash it out. You know, each desk offers a story or two or more for page one, and then you really talk about not only what's going to be on page one, but which is going to be in this position, what's going to be on top of the fold and the bottom of the fold. There's a soon-to-be outmoded idea, so you can see it in the newsstand. What size type it'll be. They decide these things with just like lapidary skill, and you know, this will be a 14-point Bookman headline to show that this is kind of a lighter story. And you know, they still do this, and yet, you know, you go to the web and that's not what you see. You see most emailed stories. And I find myself, if I quickly want to find out what's going on, I look at the most emailed stories, let the people vote on what they're interested in. And I think of these people, you know, having these meetings every day and putting into all this effort, and I just wonder how long, if that's the kind of thing that's not going to translate to news on the web. It's going to be sort of people voting with their mouse clicks, which in some ways is kind of an alarming manner, and it's kind of maybe, you know, I think there's some good things about elitism. And
well, in that they nurture good top line for the escapades, I think.
Exactly.
Does most emails correlate with most red?
Does
most emails correlate with most red?
Oh,
maybe
probably not. Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, I think the only reason that that wherever it is now keeps moving down. But you know, I'm sure it was because a lot of people on the non-Perlmutter team were probably sending emailing it around in outrage to their colleagues.
It seems to me like the most emailed ones seem to be like the ones that would be buried away and they wouldn't be made at the top.
Yeah.
They're really interesting in their own right. Somebody kind of pulls them up from the bottom.
Yeah, that's true. So yeah. I think it's nice to have both, but I just wonder if it's going to move on to that. But you're right. An encouraging amount of really good science stories in the Times end up on the most emailed list. So I hope that's because people are really reading them and sharing them with people and saying, wow, this is cool.
So get back to the Scientific American comment. I mean, one magazine that I really like is the Science News Weekly.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of little, unpretentious articles that really explain things, and it seems to be very high quality.
Yeah.
Is that something that is too technical for the...
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's probably aimed at maybe the people... the old audience maybe for Scientific American, you know, a little more sophisticated than what you'd see in Discover magazine, which is you know a little more lowbrow, I guess, in my elitist tastes. But I think Science News is really good, and they do a nice job of that, and really some of the best science writers in the profession at least are there for a while. They don't tend to stay because I guess, you know, it's not considered as prestigious. I know a lot of Washington Post people came through Science News, but I don't know.
Well, the key is in the word unpretentious.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe so. I think there's several audiences, and one is a smaller audience of, you know, really kind of non-scientists but science junkies who really follow this stuff. You know, maybe they were science majors in college and got into business or something, or maybe it's business people, you know, looking for new ideas, and someone reading Discover is maybe is a little broader audience that's kind of looking for some sort of gee whiz kind of thrill about science. You know, the universe is really inside out, or, you know, stories like that. And then Science Times is kind of maybe hovering somewhere in between there.
Scientific American salute, but sorry.
I mean, in response to the controversy that you were saying before, like, I understand the process in the case of physics, but what happens in, like, more politicized debates, like global warming, for example? Is there a lot of additional pressure, say, from pseudo-experts or non-experts to change how the process of actually writing the articles go, or is it obvious how to separate the people who are trying to drive your story in one direction from...
Yeah, I mean, you kind of get used to that. I mean, mostly what I write about is a little more insulated from that. But I've talked to my colleague who covers global warming, and yeah, I mean, he's under constant pressure from both sides, and he's been covering it long enough that he really knows the people he can go to check things out, and he also knows when the people he's going to are not thought to be the right people to go to by someone else. He really has a good mental map or a sense of the field and the controversy. So again, I'd say the balance comes out over the length of his coverage, like over the year of the Times, you'll like hear different points of view. And if there's like a legitimate, you know, it seems like a semi-legitimate minority view, you might, you know, find a way to report that. But, you know, it's not like there's two sides of equal weight to every story. You know, like, you don't, every time you write about age, you don't have to write about the guys at Stanford who still says it's not caused by HIV. You know, there's always going to be these minority views. And you had something.
I was just wondering if the Scientific American still do the articles by professors and
people? They do, yeah. And as they've always done, a lot of those are... you know, they work very closely with the editors there as far as the writing. You know, the magazine that used to really do that was this wonderful magazine called The Sciences. It was published by the New York Academy of Science. And you didn't like that?
No, but they used to rewrite your everything.
Well, yeah, maybe that's why it's so good.
No. But the art direction was fantastic.
The art direction was great. And you get these articles that were written by top flight scientists, and they had these beautiful literary leads. I mean, at least for a writer like me, you know, we thought it was a great magazine. But yeah, that's because they rewrote everything. Scientific American, to a lesser extent, does that. They certainly do it with a lot of people. I remember reading once, you know, there was a series that, I don't think it was a secret, so Robert Gallo had a two-part series, a three-part series on the AIDS, the AIDS virus, and I remember talking to one of my friends who worked with him on that, and said, so you only see you were the editor for the Gallo article, and he said, oh, well, yeah, I guess you could call me the editor. Basically, you know, we kind of badgered him for a few years to send something in, and finally, you know, he sent in some tape recordings of some talks he gave, and I had them transcribed, and then wrote the article and sent it back to him. Had it been approved. So that's how some of those things get done. Certainly, I'm sure that's an extreme case, but they still do those articles, but it's more and more staff written. I think a lot of that has to do with the German publishing company that bought it some time ago and, you know, wanted to, you know, wring more money out of it and lower common denominator or something. I think it's still a good magazine.
Yeah, something that would happen when I would read, when I used to read, I don't really like it that much anymore, but I always liked the articles by the PhDs and stuff, and I would get lost, honestly. I mean, I would read the beginning of the article, and then somewhere halfway through, I'd be very confused and pretty lost, you know. But I actually liked that. I mean, I was like, I'm glad I'm lost, you know. It kind of convinces me that these guys are doing something hard.
Exactly.
Well, I'm just wondering if you think that's just some value.
That was kind of nice. Yeah, challenged you.
I feel the same way about my talks.
But there were two things about Scientific American. One is the editors got better educated over time.
Yeah. Right?
So they wanted the articles to have more stuff in it over time until they all got fired and they changed the ownership. So that was one thing. And the other thing is all the articles seem too complicated except the ones in your own field, which are way too simple.
I don't know. I think it's good to sort of compliment the reader by doing something that might be slightly too hard for them and try to get them to work a little. But this isn't, it's not a real popular position in my craft.
I remember being inspired by Zach Burnett as a teenager.
Yeah. Yeah, you just think like, wow.
I thought it was some articles inside.
Yeah.
How could that possibly be?
Yeah. And now there's this idea that nothing's supposed to be hard. But,
Are they doing special issues now, Scientific American?
I don't know. Yeah, I guess they still do. Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, probably see it as much as you do, you know, on the newsstand sometimes. Some of those special issues are really great. Well, I think an hour, you know, is kind of enough for a talk like this. It's as long as I like to stand up and, you know, make my throat sore. So I want to thank you for coming. I hope you'll come back next week, and maybe we can just take a few minutes, and if there's anything, you know, that you'd really find it interesting for us to do in these sessions. And one thing that's occurred to me we could do is, you know, like pick, you know, if there's some interesting physics story that comes out on, you know, next week, and, you know, I could get links to several different versions, how it was covered by different reporters. We could project them and talk about them, and what's, you know, what works, what doesn't work, what they could have done better. You know, that's something we could do. And in one session, I could talk about, you know, how you write a book, and maybe Bob can come and chime in. Are the wonderful experience of sending your book to the publisher, and they, by the time they get it, they vaguely remember you were supposed to write something to do with science, and then the publicist who's 22 years old and just got out of Radcliffe and is in charge of your publicity campaign. We could talk about things like that.
How about Lee Smolin's book, which would draw a big audience?
Do you want to do something on that? I was thinking, I mean, I included my review in the reading material, but maybe we could do a session on that next week, and we could get links to like five or six of the reviews of the books and then use that as a talking point.
I mean, we've got some real the experts are all
exactly. Yeah, I'd love to do that. My only my only hesitation is maybe, you know, people were tired of the small and white wars, but
well, you can ask them.
Yeah.
Yeah, there have been, you know, thoughts.
Yeah, let's do that then. Okay, and. Yeah, I know on the... Yeah, let's do that. I'll send around an email over the weekend, early next week, with links to as many of the, you know, the really interesting reviews that I can find. And then, you know, just talk about the whole thing and just how these, you know, we were talking about this, I guess, Tuesday night. Steve Schenker had me and a few of his colleagues up in the tower with a bottle of scotch, and we were talking about this whole thing, just how this kind of coverage seems to spin out of control, or, you know, we'll get into this next week. But, you know, if two books didn't happen to come out at the same time, it wouldn't be, you know, nearly as big a deal in the media probably as it is.
I would say the American media, because the amount of noise that's being made really differs in different countries.
Oh, that'd be good to hear. I didn't know that. So let's do that. Okay.
For those of us who won't be here next week, can we send you our insults to the books by mail?
Oh, please.
Send them to the office.
we'll pass them along. Yeah, we'll get Lee Smolin in on video. just Lee Way, with all due respect and with complete admiration for all the hard things you've done, I must respectfully say that, yeah.
As much fun as it would be to hear the inside story on all this, I think one of the values of you being here is to understand that there's a much larger uninformed community out there that's also hearing this discussion without the benefit of information, and how it's presented in different media would be very interesting.
Yeah, I'll talk about that.
Story of how it's
sounds good. Okay. Anything else? Okay, thank you for coming. Okay.